Hi, welcome to No Narrow Thing. Today we're doing something a little bit different, and we are lucky enough to be able to talk with Jana Morlone today about philosophy and education, especially her work in philosophy for children.
Jana is the director and founder of the UW Center for Philosophy for Children. She's also the president of the philosophy learning and teaching organization called Plato.
And we're really excited to talk with her today.
So let's go to that. Well, Jana, thank you so much for being with us. We're so excited to have you here. Talk about philosophy for children.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So will you just tell us a little bit about what philosophy for children is? I imagine most people think of philosophy and they think of these big, hard questions, not necessarily the sort of questions you ask in a first grade class.
Right. I think most people who have any experience of philosophy, it tends to be in an undergraduate classroom. And that really primarily tends to involve looking at the arguments that either the great philosophers or contemporary philosophers have made and trying to understand those arguments and then respond to them. And of course, yeah, we don't go into first grade classrooms and try and teach them Descartes' dream argument or something like that. And in fact, philosophy for children really doesn't involve teaching philosophy at all. Mm-hmm. Really, the point of it is to engage with children about the philosophical questions they're already reflecting about. So we will come in with some kind of a prompt, whether it's a story or an activity, and then follow the conversation based on the children's questions and comments. So, the reason for doing this is that children do tend to wonder a lot about big philosophical questions. And it's interesting. So when you started, you said, you know, people think of philosophy as involving big, complex, difficult questions. And I think that's right.
Yeah.
But the thing that I think people don't understand or acknowledge is that children are quite capable of engaging with those questions. They're not necessarily capable of engaging with Aristotle's take on those questions, but they are capable of thinking about questions like, what is a good life? Or what is happiness? Or can something exist if it doesn't have a beginning, etc.? And because many children are already thinking about some of those questions, having a space in which to talk about these things with other students is really powerful. Because it is an acknowledgement that children are capable of grappling with such serious, difficult questions. And B, it really is one of the few spaces, at least in a school setting, where the point is not to get the one right answer. Because in philosophical inquiry, there isn't one right answer. There are answers that are better than others. There are final answers to some of these questions. But once we come upon those final answers, then that question ceases to be philosophical, right? Because philosophical questions tend to be questions for which the answers continue to be contestable and open-ended. And so it provides children with this sort of agency, right, about how to explore these questions and what might be possible answers, instead of what is often the case where there's only one answer and they're supposed to get it right. And so it can be a really powerful experience for young people because it engages them in their own thinking about whatever the topic is and really follows their own lead in how to examine the question that's being explored.
Yeah, I think that approach is so fascinating because you do get these topics touched on in other classes. You know, an English class might talk about ethics. They might read Crime and Punishment or something and talk about, you know, what's the right thing to do.
Right.
Other classes do touch on these topics. How would you say the philosophy for children approach differs?
Well, I think that what often happens, unfortunately, in classrooms where those questions come up is they don't really get taken up, right? Because it's not part of the lesson plan for the day. And there's actually been some research about this, the complex, big questions that young people ask in, say, high school English classrooms or history classrooms. Often the teachers kind of don't know where to go with that.
Yeah.
And so they really don't engage with it. So I'm not sure that it's that we who do philosophy for children have some approach that's really different than what you might use in a situation like that. I think it's more that we are very focused on having a philosophical ear and really listening for those questions and comments that raise these big questions, and then being willing to facilitate these kinds of discussions with young people and children. And one of the things that's really different about that from sort of your ordinary classroom, particularly in public schools, is that I don't have the answers either, right? So I'm not up there as the person who, okay, now I'm going to tell you what free will is now that we've had this discussion, because I don't know.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's really valuable and exciting and always inspiring about doing this work is that I learn from children all the time who see things frequently with a very fresh perspective and come up with a way of looking at a question or a topic that will sort of make me think about it differently. And that's really rewarding.
It's funny that you say that, actually, because even in this podcast, I find myself as an adult thinking that Dustin has the answers to the things that we're talking about because he's the philosopher. And I wonder if you've seen sort of a change in the thinking of the adults that interact with Philosophy for Children as a program in terms of their thinking around how to educate children and youth, or their own, like, how do I deal with complexity? And
yeah, I think that's a great question. And yes, on both counts. And actually, I'm just finishing a graduate and undergraduate class at the U this quarter. And I've just been looking at some of the comments my students, when they sent their papers into me, sent me emails saying those kinds of things. I mean, that they've never had a philosophy class before where they felt like they were really exploring the questions that interested them, and that there was this community of people that they knew everyone's names, and people really started to understand how different people thought and how powerful that was. And I think a couple of things happened. One is that even philosophy majors, you know, at the university, think of philosophy as something done by the experts. And those experts are then teaching them about the subject. And our work is really trying to kind of reclaim philosophy as something all of us do all the time. And there are obviously different levels at which people do it, right? So there are people who have PhDs in philosophy and they're engaging with the, you know, current work in philosophy at a really high level. But everyone, I think, at some point in your year even, or in your week, thinks about something like, is this the right thing to do? Or is this person really a good friend? Or is this really who I am if I'm going to do whatever this thing I might be doing is? And those are all philosophical questions. But I think people don't think of themselves as engaging in philosophy. And I think that's partly the fault of the discipline, because the discipline has a lot of gatekeeping qualities, which is really too bad. And I think doesn't serve the discipline very well, ultimately, because it narrows it and really keeps it smaller and smaller. So I think that's part of it. And I think one of the things people start to discover as they engage in these conversations themselves is that they have really thoughtful things to contribute about many of these questions. Mm-hmm. I do a monthly PLC, which you missed. It was so great this week. With a group of primarily teachers, but also graduate students and faculty, et cetera. And it's really interesting to watch the emergence of this community coming out of this group. It's about 20 people roughly, and the ways in which many of the teachers are becoming more and more confident about their own philosophical voices. So that's one thing that happens. The other thing that I see happening all the time, and that several of my undergraduates remarked on in the emails they sent me or their papers, is that they start to see children differently. I had several undergraduates actually say to me this quarter in emails or papers that this course made them realize all their biases about children. And that now they see children, they take what children say more seriously, that they really realize that some of the things I talk about, that, you know, when children say thoughtful or serious things, we tend to remark on how cute it is or how adorable they are or how funny it is, or we just think, oh, they can't possibly know what they're talking about. And the students were saying, you know, I realize I thought like that. And being around these students in philosophy classes in the schools really changed that, because I saw how capable they are of thinking about these questions. So,
It's interesting when people talk about interacting with children that one of the tricks to interacting with a kid is to treat them like an adult and they'll really appreciate it. But I'm not sure it's treating them as adults so much as it is just treating them seriously as like real humans rather than a joke or a cute toy or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. I mean, what's so weird is that we have like, we're all developing all the time, mm-hmm. right? But we put children in this special place, like your development is all about becoming an adult whenever that happens and whatever that means, because you know, who knows, right? And while you're a child, whatever that means, we don't really take you seriously until you start to become like an adult. So our idea of treating you seriously is to treat you like an adult, which seems to me really bizarre when you think about it, right? Because any stage of life you're in, you have these unique perspectives or insights that come from whatever it is that's happening in your world. And the same is true for children. And in fact, when you think about it, what happens in childhood is one, if not the most powerful times in our life, because it does shadow us the rest of our lives, right? Who we are as children, or our experiences as children, or how we see the world as children, stays with us in powerful ways, and in ways that I think is really different from kind of other parts of our lives. And yet we look at it as a kind of a throwaway stage and good only for turning you into an adult, which is, it's really, I mean, the more I think about it, the more kind of odd it is.
I mean, that's so interesting, because when I think of my childhood, I do think of these revelatory moments where I wondered something. I realized I could question my religious beliefs or what I thought my teachers knew. Like, they're not the experts I thought they were. Like, moments of like wonder and confusion and a kind of terrifying freedom that comes with that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But when I think naturally as adults, when we look at children, we don't even think of them as capable of having those sorts of moments, when those are some of the most emotional moments of your life, is when you first wonder something
exactly.
like that.
It's like, how we forget this. Like, we look at kids and we forget, like, we were all children, right? So we know this is the case. But yet when we talk to children, we don't acknowledge that.
I wonder too, if the flip side of that, reading some of the posts on your blog, I was struck by how, you know, philosophy for children works because it taps into their natural sort of sense of wonderment, et cetera. And part of being a quote unquote adult is actually cutting yourself off from, you know, allowing yourself to wonder, to be curious in that same way. So I was thinking, you know, if philosophy for children actually could stymie that sort of that separation between childhood and adulthood, or at least help adults be more curious and have a sense of wonder about the world in a way that we're not usually allowed to.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, one of the things that I think is really important about the work is that it also gives children the message that wondering is a really valuable thing to do and an important way to spend your time, because I think we get the messages, children or young people, that we should move on from that and focus on, you know, what job we're going to get or whatever.
Yes.
And I think wondering is a really fundamental part of being a human being. And why would you want to give that up, right?
Yeah.
And maybe one of the things that happens when you're an adult, or as you become an adult, is you start to be afraid of sounding naive or making a mistake or not sounding smart enough.
Yeah.
And so the playfulness with ideas that comes with wondering starts to become something that's a little scary for adults, right? One of the things that I love about working with kids is constantly I will hear kids say things like, huh, now that I hear Dustin say that, I think I've changed my mind about that.
Yeah.
I think I was wrong about it. And they're just so willing to do that without any worry about, you know, if that's like a shameful thing or shows that they weren't smart enough. They don't care about that at all, at least not until, you know, maybe age 11 or 12. But before that, between 5 and 11, they are just really willing to throw themselves into thinking about something without worrying about that. And I think maybe there's really a connection between wonder and sort of self-consciousness about, you know, how, I don't know, sophisticated you sound or whatever.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. I think there's this also worry about like being caught
yeah.
as an adult.
Yes.
Being called out or caught in some way is not knowing something, right. not being in the in,
yeah.
in a way that kids don't necessarily have.
Yep.
Which is neat. I wish, which is bad also about the way that we treat it, our adults in adulthood.
And I think the more that I work with children, the more it's freed me to feel really comfortable when someone's talking and I don't know what they're, I have no idea what they're talking about, to say, excuse me, I don't know anything about that. Could you explain what you mean? And like, I mean, I'm not worried. Like, maybe I should know it, but I don't. So,
yeah.
I mean, it should be a prototypical philosophical skill.
Mm-hmm.
This humility of, if there's the original image of a person we want to be like, it's Socrates who can say, well, I know that I don't know this and I'll admit it.
Right.
But that doesn't feel like anyone I know.
Certainly not in graduate programs.
Not graduate programs, not professors. Certainly not undergrads, which reach a peak of arrogance at a certain right. point. But I do feel like you do see that in the classrooms in philosophy for children of excitement at not knowing something. And it even comes up when they realize your approach is different from the standard school approach, that yes. you're legitimately opening the space for them to figure something out.
Yeah. And I don't know why that is. I mean, there is this disconnect between the discipline's sort of most basic claims about yeah. what the point of philosophy is and how it's actually carried out.
Yeah.
And, I mean, when I was a graduate student, one of the things that saved me was philosophy for children, because I felt like so much of the time I was in these classrooms with everyone posturing to show how philosophically sophisticated they were.
Yeah.
And it was just not very interesting.
I felt the same way. So there was my idea as an undergrad of what philosophy was. And it was just like the perfect endeavor. I was like, this is the coolest thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then getting into the actual profession of it, and it was alienating. I was like, this isn't this sort of exciting, wondering, inquiry-based project that I was hoping for. I met you, I got into the philosophy for children, and I feel like I found that again. Yeah. What was your, how did you get into philosophy yeah. for children?
A few things happened. Before I was a graduate student, while I was a graduate student, before and while, I was a full-time lawyer. And I did a lot of work with women and children, and got really interested in how to empower children to take control themselves over what was happening in their lives. Because the work I was doing, which tended to involve primarily domestic violence and family violence, children, the law could come in and try and fix situations. The law wasn't really capable of empowering individual children to move on from whatever it was they were facing with some greater sense of autonomy and ability to trust their perspectives about what was happening and trust their ability to do something about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I got really interested in that. And at the same time, I was doing my master's in philosophy at the U and started to think about education as maybe where I wanted to go next, because I was kind of burning out on the law's way of approaching these problems. So, and then I had my first child and I took a year off with him and then decided I was going to do the PhD. I wasn't going to go back to being a lawyer. And while I was working on the dissertation, at that point I was starting the dissertation. I'd already done the master's. And I was doing my dissertation in philosophy of law. A couple of things happened. I read Gareth Matthews' book, Philosophy of Childhood, which was really a revelation for me, and he had been a professor of mine. So I got in touch with him and said, I'm really interested in this. And he was the loveliest man. I don't know if you ever met him. He was the just most gentle, lovely, caring person and completely devoid of philosophical arrogance. I mean, so he introduced me to all these people. It was sort of like, you should get involved with these people. You know, he introduced me to Matt Lippman and various other people. And so that was happening on the one hand, and I started to just look at that work and think about it. It was very new to me. And then the other thing that was happening is my oldest son by then, so I had, by then I had two I have three boys. By then I had two of them. My oldest was about four when I had finished the PhD. And he was starting to ask these questions, right? Are numbers real? Can you be happy and sad at the same time? And it was, and of course I recognized that these were philosophical questions and started to think about whether philosophy was something children could do. And I think it was right around that time I read Gary's book. And so I asked Will's kindergarten teacher, I think it was preschool, if I could come in and do a little philosophy session with the children. And so there were probably 12 children in that class. And I came in with one of the Frog and Toad stories, which raises questions about bravery, and had this, I'll never forget it, 'cause I was like terrified. I mean, I taught undergraduates, I'd never taught kids, but it was so lovely. And these were really young children. They were 4 and 5. So, you know, we talked for maybe 20 minutes, but they were totally interested in talking about bravery and had all kinds of things to say about it and the connection between bravery and fear. And so that's really what led me to start thinking that children were philosophically capable, even children that young, but also that this might be a way to circle back to my thinking as a lawyer to help children to develop the ability to take control over the circumstances of their own lives. Because I thought about my own childhood and growing up with parents who were, you know, very loving, but who were in a world and a lifestyle that I knew pretty early was not going to be for me. And that one of the things that made a big difference for me was really trusting my own judgment about what I saw and what I wanted and being confident about articulating that both for myself and to other people. And that ability to reason through a problem, to recognize what assumptions you're making, to kind of question yourself and really feel confident about your own way of seeing the world. I don't know that there's anything more important, really, in getting through life. I mean, it's such a powerful way to live your life, to kind of have that. I mean, no one has it fully, of course, but to have some of that. And that maybe philosophy was going to be one of the ways to help children to gain this, because in large part, it does deal with these unsettled questions. And so it does create this space for children to explore what matters to them, to find their voices without this overarching pressure of, you know, there's a right answer I'm supposed to get, and which I think makes it that works for some kids, but it sure doesn't work for all kids.
Yeah. Right? Do you ever find yourself in that being pushed to, I guess, feel like you have to address kind of the discomfort of those open questions, either for the children themselves or the adults around them?
Yeah, it's usually the adults, right? So, I mean, it's interesting. I did when we did this little video a couple of years ago about philosophical children, and in it, I believe, one of the fifth grade students who was being interviewed, you know, she was asked, I mean, what do you like about philosophy? And she said, I like that there aren't final answers. I like to hear all these different perspectives. And one of the adults asked her, you know, I think it was at a University of Washington program. One of the adults asked her, don't you want the answers? And she was like, no, I just want to think about it. But the adults always ask that, right? Mm-hmm. Often ask me that, like, aren't children uncomfortable with not having the answers? And I think, you know, children learn to become uncomfortable mm-hmm. with not having the answers, because that's the messages they get in school and at home, that answers are really important. But I think if you create an environment in which questioning is important and in which you can develop a comfort with uncertainty, I think that's really valuable for children, because the fact of the matter is a lot of the questions that we all think about in our lives, whether they're big political questions or individual personal questions, we don't have the answers. And so wanting the final answers is kind of problematic, right? Because you're going to be dissatisfied.
Yeah. And we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a little bit.
We're back. And to follow up on what we were just talking about, which was the discomfort people can feel with ambiguity, I'm wondering a little bit about the nature of philosophical questions, which can be sort of
controversial
topics, touchy topics. How do you navigate that when you're talking about things like murder or stealing.
Right. Yeah. Well, all of these topics do come up, and sometimes it is sticky. And it's interesting because I always often find, especially if it's a classroom I haven't been in for a long time, that the teacher's a little anxious at when, you know, a certain topic comes up, like, you know, should we shut this down? But I tend to not to do that. I mean, I tend to really go with where the kids want to take the conversation within this framework, right? That we're, at the beginning, we usually create some rules for how we're going to do philosophy together. So, and it, the children often suggest it includes things like listening to each other and respecting what each other has to say. So we have that framework, as well as giving reasons, the best reasons we can come up with for what it is we want to say. So that framework really helps. So you don't just get, you know, the kind of shouting matches that you see on, you know, television news or whatever, news shows or whatever, right? So it's not like that. But, you know, particularly since the last presidential election, mm-hmm. there's been a lot of talk that comes up from the children about the political situation. A lot of the schools in which we teach in Seattle, there are a lot of immigrant children. So there's been some anxiety about the current political situation in their families and for them personally. And really, I think what always amazes me is how, for the most part, not always, of course, but for the most part, children are pretty well able to navigate those topics in respectful ways. And so, for example, there are a couple of examples. One was, there was a class I taught that was like the day after the election last year, in a fifth grade class, and several of the students, I'm trying to remember what the topic of conversation was. I can't quite remember, but several of the students raised, you know, how now we were going to have this terrible president, and how could people vote for him, and anyone who voted for him had to be racist. And one of the kids in the class said, well, wait a minute. I mean, just because someone votes for a particular candidate doesn't mean that they are voting for everything that candidate thinks. I mean, some people might have voted for him for, I can't remember the reasons he said. He said, and isn't the really important part of being a democracy is that people get to choose who they think is the best candidate, even if you don't agree? And it turned into this really nice conversation mm-hmm. about how you almost have a better sense of how important democracy is when you don't like the candidate who is chosen than when you do. It was really interesting. And kind of related, we had a conversation about a few months later about the whole taking the knee practice. And it was really interesting because some of the students were very strongly in favor of, supportive of this, right? I mean, this is what America's all about, if you want to protest. And then there were several students who were actually new to the country, who were new immigrants, and who were very uncomfortable with it. And one of the young girls said, I have to say that, like, and she was African-American. I mean, she said, I know that why they're doing this. And I certainly am anti-racist and want and understand there's police brutality, but it makes me so uncomfortable when people don't stand for the national anthem that I can't even think about what it is they're trying to say. I just don't understand why you would protest in that way. And it was really interesting. And so we had this conversation about what was the discomfort. And she said, I just think it's all about respect. Like, you live in a country and you it's really important to have respect for the country's traditions, even if there are things that are going on that you don't agree with. And it was really interesting. Wow. And, you know, these are fifth graders. And I thought, could we just put these children on national television and have them have these conversations as opposed to what's currently happening?
It's really something that they can do that, because I think, you know, we're recording this around the holidays. And there's the joke, like, oh, don't talk about politics or religion mm-hmm. or whatever at right. the dinner table, especially not with your relatives who you don't really see. And I don't know if that rule made us worse at having these conversations, or adults were bad at it and therefore the rule was generated about what you're supposed to talk about or not supposed to talk about?
You know, it's interesting. So we do this high school ethics bowl every year, right? And where high school students from around the region, it's all over the country, around the region, come to the University of Washington, and they have dialogues in teams from various schools about big ethical cases. So it can be anything from, you know, was it acceptable for Brazil to put all this money into the World Cup when people are starving, to is it okay to date your best friend's former partner? And what's always really interesting, so we usually have about 100 to 150 high school students there. And then the winner, the school that wins the ethics bowl at the University of Washington, goes to the national competition at the University of North Carolina in the spring. And what's always fascinating is adults say to me every year who are there as the judges, we need one of these for adults, because you listen to these young people have conversations about very controversial, difficult topics, and they are so willing to listen to each other and so respectful of each other's points of view. And really, and you hear all the time them say, huh, we hadn't thought about that point. That's really interesting. That makes us see this a little differently. It's so inspiring. Yeah. And so it seemed, and you know, people say this about an ethics bowl for adults. I don't think they're really kidding. I mean, it's sort of, why can't we have these conversations within frameworks where we're coming in knowing we're coming at it from different perspectives, right? And I think you can start off by saying, what are the things we all agree on, right? I mean, we're all trying, for example, to make the country a better place. How we think that will be might have really different ideas about it, right? So what is the common ground that we can start with, however broad in general? And then that's, I think, creates this atmosphere of trust and willingness to listen, which seems to be so sorely lacking in our national conversations about politics, among other things.
That's true. I wonder too, though, I was just in this conversation with a friend of mine about how hard it is to engage even close friends of ours in conversations about quote unquote sticky topics that we find, especially now, are quite necessary on our minds all the time, whether it's issues of racism, immigration, sexism, et cetera. And most of the people in our lives don't even want to engage. And I wonder if it's a discomfort in not having the answer, in that these topics are so personal, or something else, that even participating within rules, within close relationships, just like we just don't have the desire. We're apathetic mostly.
I don't wonder if it's apathy as much as it is fear of being labeled, right? There's so much of that goes on, no matter where you are, it seems to me, on the political spectrum. If you put forth a view that's slightly unorthodox compared to the other people who are roughly in the same place you are on the political spectrum, you're easily labeled. Oh, you know, she's not as enlightened as I thought she was, or, oh, you know, whatever. And I think people are really cautious, right? They're really cautious about being honest. Right. I mean, I've had several conversations with really close friends in which they have said things like, well, I would say this to you, but I would never say this publicly. And that always makes me so sad. Like, why? Why not? You know? And I think the other piece of that is the whole social media thing, right? Which we haven't really talked about, but the effect of people, if they really do put their views out there in a really public way, that can be a pretty painful experience, right? And scary, because there's really a lot of, and this sort of anonymous, not, I wouldn't call it a community because it's not a community, this anonymous, I don't know, kind of amorphous framework that's created by social media, where people feel really comfortable saying the most awful things to one another, right? In ways they would never do that if they were sitting in a room with other people.
Do you think that's a net positive or a negative, that on one hand we're recognizing as a society the harms done by even words, that, you know, the way that we phrase things and say things can be oppressive or marginalize people. At the same time, for people to fear putting out a provisional stance is also not ideal.
Right.
And so as someone who's concerned with justice and not harming people while at the same time valuing dialogue among competing positions, what do we do? Especially when we don't have good models out there and in the public sphere of how to have respectful yet challenging conversations.
And I think in part that's all about trust, right? Because that's when you're in some kind of an environment where you really trust that people are going to try and listen to each other without prejudging or immediately judging someone because they haven't used the right language or they're putting forth a point of view that might be controversial. I think that's really hard to do. I think social media is just not the right forum for that. I think it doesn't, just the nature of it doesn't create trust. How could it? Right? You're unless you're in a closed group, right? But that's different. That's really not social media in the public sense.
Is it that we're treating like tweets as official statements or something? Because if I even catch myself doing it, of if someone said something in the room to me, I'd be like, oh, I know what they mean. Mm-hmm. But if I see a tweet phrase certain, I'm like, yikes. Right. Whoops.
Right. You know, exactly.
Like some standards are being invoked by the context.
Yeah, exactly. And there's often no context, right? It's like anything else. You say something in a room in the middle of a conversation that carries itself in a certain way. And then you put it as itself in a statement in a newspaper article or in a tweet or whatever.
Yeah.
And it sounds really different.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Which is just taking things out of context, right? Which has been an age-old problem, but now it's just been magnified by the current technological advances or whatever you want to call them.
And I think that the way that social media and communicating through technology, those norms are actually seem to be coming into more of our in-person conversational norms and behaviors too, in a way that isn't necessarily always positive. But this kind of like quick to judge, slow to listen, or really ask critical questions to get to actually maybe what the person really did mean instead of what they sort of said off the cuff.
Exactly.
Is interesting. So, and at the same time, I wonder if there are sort of like shorthand skills that we have as children that we lose through the course of sort of our normal educational process to give people that like gracious space. But I observe it all the time in meetings, both personally and professionally, this like, oh, why did you say that? That's stupid.
Right. And I mean, I don't want to idealize children, right? Because I think plenty of that goes on between children too. But I think part of that, I don't know that the answer to this necessarily or a way of looking at this has to do so much with children and adults. I think it has to do more with being in a space with other people where there's some kind of environment created that of trust and respect and not being in such a space. And I think that really to me is the difference, not so much the age of the people involved or whatever. I think it's a good thing that we are, at least many of us in our society, are trying to be more careful about language, are trying to really think about where words come from and how they might affect people who are different than we are. But I also think that there's a balance between that sort of sensitivity and being quick to label someone based on them using language or putting things in ways that really strikes the wrong chord with you personally. And I think, again, it's about trust, right? It's about being able to say to someone, huh, so when you say that, I hear this. Is that what you mean? Which is different than saying, oh, you must be, a misogynist or whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, this is something we've talked about in going into this podcast and I think has a lot of connection with philosophy for children, which is the idea that doing philosophy live is messy and it's tentative and you go down, avenues that don't always work and you realize you said something totally false that you don't
Absolutely.
Agree with.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And So in some ways, our standards of accountability mm-hmm. about the statements people make, the norms have to be different for a philosophical question because it's hard and you have to stumble around because that's part of the process of philosophical
and
work.
And part of the way I think that happens that's healthy is to have, and we have this in the PLC with, you know, which is all adults, people sort of putting forth an idea. I mean, it happens to me all the time and then listening and thinking, okay, wait a minute, that's completely wrong what I just said. That can't be right. And being able to say, so now that I'm thinking about this, I'm realizing that this actually really doesn't make sense because such and such. And that, I think that kind of environment where you're really willing to do that makes for change. I mean, that really does create a space in which people can sort of puzzle things out loud without feeling like they're making some final statement about it that they're going to be held accountable for, because you can't think with other people if that's what you're doing. And I mean, it's sort of more, I think, like how scientists work, right? They're mm-hmm. trying to work together on a problem, and there's all kinds of possibilities thrown out, most of which won't end up going anywhere, right?
Yeah. Even realizing you don't agree with something you said a minute ago is a discovery. It's not a loss. You've figured something out.
Exactly. Yeah.
So two clarifying questions for me. What is the PLC? And if it sounds like both sort of Philosophy for Children and the PLC succeed because it creates spaces of trust and relationship from which to have these sort of dialogues and come to conclusions together, not in competition, but in collaboration. Mm-hmm. And if traditional academia and traditional sort of American educational spaces do not do that, how do we spread those best behaviors into sort of traditional spaces of development?
So the first question is easier to answer than the second. and sorry about that. I try not to use little jargony acronyms. But the PLC is, so we've been doing this monthly workshop for teachers that we've been doing for a long time for quite a number of years. We would do it in individual schools. So we'd come into the school once a month and work with a group of teachers in that school doing a philosophy session.
Cool.
We started this year doing it at the University of Washington mm-hmm. as a way of allowing more teachers to participate, bringing in different teachers who get to know each other. And it's been really great. And so PLC stands for Professional Learning Community, which is a term that teachers use.
Gotcha.
So they get clock hours for this, and it's a kind of a continuing education sort of thing.
Gotcha. Very cool.
Yeah. So that's what that is. In terms of how to move more collaborative, open-ended spaces of trust and listening and respect into the institutions around us, of course, that's a huge question. I will say that at least in Seattle, I see most of the classrooms into which I go, almost all of which are public schools, pretty big classrooms, you know, fifth grade, 28 to 30-something kids. Mm-hmm. As spaces where the teachers are working on that all the time, are really, I mean, against great odds, right? Because we're living in a time where there's a lot of pressure on them to meet certain standards, to have certain testing results, et cetera. But at the same time that they're trying to manage all of that, they are dealing with students who are from very diverse backgrounds, really trying to create communities of learning. I mean, teachers know better than anyone that in a classroom, if you don't have a community of respect and trust, it's going to be hard for anyone to learn anything. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't think this is not new to Philosophy for Children. It's not, I mean, this is something good classroom teachers have known for a very long time and work very hard at. Now, whether that's going on in Congress and other political institutions, that's a whole different question. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's take a break and we'll be right back. We're back, and I want to ask a little bit about how Philosophy for Children changes individual students. You know, they're in a typical school, they go to class, they take their tests, a philosopher comes in and changes everything, presumably, for them. How does it change them?
Well, so first I would say I'm not sure it changes everything for
yeah.
them, and I'm not sure it changes anything for everyone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I think there are students who have really powerful transformative experiences engaging with this. And I actually will hear sometimes, we do these events twice a year now for parents, where parents and kids come and we have these conversations about philosophy in mixed groups of parents and children. It's really fun. Mm. And I've several times had parents show up who've said to me, you know, my child had philosophy with you 6 years ago when he was in fifth grade and he's now a junior at Garfield or whatever. And it was like one of the best things that ever happened to him because he found a place where, I mean, this is typically the kind of thing I hear, where that allowed him to realize that the questions he thinks about all the time, it isn't just him, that other people are thinking about these questions. And so that's one thing that happens. The other thing that I've had several students tell me is that it gave them more confidence in their own thinking, so more willingness to sort of put themselves out there with stating a point of view and trusting that they had good reason for their points of view. So I think those are the two things that I see. The other thing that we hear, you know, anecdotal stories, we are in the midst of doing a couple of more focused studies, but we hear anecdotal stories from teachers about diminished conflict. Mm. So for example, we'll hear things like one teacher told me, a year or two ago, this was in a second grade class. She said that she was hearing her students out in the playground when they disagreed, saying things like, well, that's your view. I have a different view. She said it was like right out of philosophy and it was really different than, you know, you're stupid. And So I think there is some of that. I mean, we try to help cultivate that mm-hmm. in the classroom to help students see that you can have a different point of view from someone else. And it doesn't mean one of you has to be wrong and the other right. That actually there are many ways to see the world. Mm-hmm. And all these different points of view add up to a pretty rich perspective. You don't need to hold on to just one of them as if it's the only possibility. Mm-hmm. So,
but that makes me think of is one thing that I've learned through this is that I've conflated philosophical education with sort of moral education and this mm-hmm. idea that learning philosophy or philosophical inquiry as a skill will help you be a more ethical, moral person, which it doesn't sound like that's your position either.
Well, so that's, I mean, I was just having this conversation with someone actually who asked me, I think it was an interview I did recently, who asked me just that. Do you think an ethical education leads to someone being a more moral person? Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure this answer is fully or as well considered as I would like it to be, but at least provisionally, I would say that I think there's something really powerful and character building about learning how to think through moral problems. So actually engaging with the problems themselves, especially if there are problems that are personally relevant to you, and thinking through them with other people. Like, is it really okay to date your best friend's former partner? Right? I mean, that's a question that many people grapple with in their lives, right? And it's not an easy question, right? And right. often what we want to do and what we should do get conflated, right? So I think there's real value in helping people to look at questions like that thoughtfully and with a degree of distance from their impulses. I think that's very different than studying ethics, right? So learning about utilitarianism, which is an ethical theory, or Kant's view of ethics, or Hume's. There's just too much evidence that knowing all those theories really well does not make you a more ethical person yeah. for, I think, anyone to reasonably claim that it does. So I think those are two very different things. So I think learning ethics, or, and I think similarly, you know, there's a lot of programs in schools now that are kind of character education, right? Mm-hmm. Today, this month's virtue is tolerance. So everyone's going to get, you know, gold stars for how tolerant they are. I'm skeptical about the efficacy of programs like that for similar reasons. I just, it's hard for me to imagine that without even examining what tolerance even means, mm-hmm. right? Because, of course, we don't want everyone to be tolerant all the time. We don't want you to be tolerant of racism, for example, right? We don't want you to be tolerant of violence. So it's kind of an unexamined way of trying to teach children, you know, things that are valuable, right? And because in general, yes, tolerance is a virtue and kindness is a virtue too. But I think helping children or adults to actually think about what those things mean mm-hmm. is way more powerful than either the virtue of the month or in studying what a great historical figure thinks about those things. Because I think those things tend to then be kind of distant from you, a little bit abstract mm. and not really engaging you as a person. So I think that's what I would say is the difference. And again, I need to think about it some more. But I do, in general, I think that's about what I think.
On that subject of reasoning through moral questions, I sometimes can detect a tension between the philosophical method of inquiry, of questioning everything and thinking things through, mm-hmm. and the like autocratic strain in schools, which mm-hmm. like, these are the rules, you follow mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. You ask me why, I'm going to tell you that's just the way it is. Right. Follow the rules.
Right.
What do you think about that? Is that a tension? How do you navigate it?
I think it is a tension. I think it's a tension more in some schools and some classrooms than in others. And I think that at least for us, being not full-time classroom teachers, but people who come into a school and create this space with children, say once a week over the course of the school year, I think all we can reasonably do is create a space that's different from that.
Yeah.
And that is focused on giving children agency, on sort of seeing whether having the children, for example, create the rules themselves mm-hmm. becomes a more powerful experience for them in terms of actually having those rules mean something other than, you know, they won't get to go to recess if they don't follow them. And then, you know, we've certainly had lots of examples of teachers watching that process and saying to us, this is really interesting.
Yeah.
I would not have expected the students to react in this way. So I think it can be really enlightening for teachers. And I will say too, I mean, we feel really privileged because we get to work with these amazing teachers, and I learn a lot from teachers. I mean, they know these kids, right? I mean, they're in the trenches with these kids every day, mm-hmm. all day. And so I think sometimes there's a tendency to kind of overstate the whole school rigidity mm-hmm. model, you know, school's a place where you're supposed to know the answers and kids are oppressed. And yeah. I mean, I think that's a caricature,
yeah.
at least in my experience. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
That's good to know someone who hasn't been in primary school for a while. Because that's schools sort of my memory.
Schools have changed a lot, at least. I mean, for me, when I walk into a classroom, it's the way the students are seated, the sort of project-based learning that's going on, the collaborative education that's happening. I mean, there's all kinds of things happening in classrooms now that have changed quite a bit over the last, say, 20 years.
That's good. Yeah. Oh boy, 20 years. That makes me feel old. part of what this is making me thinking of, and sorry, Justin, this is a bit of an aside, was so I went to Garfield and we had this program called Cultural Relations. Uh-huh. And it was a time when students took charge of the classroom for like two class periods during 1 week of time. And got to pose these questions like, is abortion unethical? Mm-hmm. You know, things about religion and kind of topics that were on kids' minds, I uh-huh. guess. And pretty much every conversation I remember being in completely devolved into like attacking other students. Uh-huh. So rather than being actually a time for us to learn from different perspectives and cultures, it became mostly like, oh, let's try to single out this one kid who seems kind of conservative.
Wow.
Yeah, which, I mean, it just makes me sad.
It wasn't the most well-managed idea.
No. No, it was not. But it was, sadly, I think it was a missed opportunity.
Yeah, because I think that I think conversations like that need to be moderated. Mm-hmm. You can't just have it be a free-for-all. And so if you have someone who's a skilled moderator, I think those could have been really, mm-hmm. really strong and helpful experiences, but it sounds like that wasn't happening.
Yes. Yeah. No, it was not. But that makes me think, are there other things that you've observed where maybe a philosophical sort of education in childhood or at some period of a youth's time in school, where it's obvious that they haven't developed those skills, or with those skills, the conversation might be different. They might be better moderators or facilitators or something like that.
Well, I mean, there's all kinds of things in life, right, that we see every day that are great examples of that. The way people talk to each other, talk over each other, don't really listen to what the person with whom they're talking has to say, caricature what they're saying. Because one of the things we really push students on is you have to be, if you're disagreeing with someone's view, you have to be able to present it as positively and charitably as possible, right? You have to really see the view in its best light, and then you can provide reasons why you think it's wrong. But you can't caricature it so that, you know, it's, anyone would think it was wrong, right? And that's what happens all the time now, right? So we're not really taking seriously other points of view or really trying to think about them. We're just knocking them down. That's it's more like bowling than it is like philosophy.
That makes me think that actually maybe some of the problem is that we're in such a hyper competitive culture. Mm-hmm. So where it's actually would be against the sort of our hyper productive capitalist grain to create spaces of trust and grace and relationship to have these conversations.
You know, I wonder about that. People say that sometimes, and I'm a little bit skeptical, I guess, because it seems to me that the diminishment of public civility has had a much shorter life than capitalism and democracy, and that there used to be, I think, way more disinclination to be disrespectful, to, you know, yell down the other side. I mean, that really, I think, so I'm not sure that what's happening is happening just in capitalist democracies either, because we see it all over the world in all kinds of systems. So I think, I don't see that it's the hyper-competitiveness that necessarily is the issue as much as just the breakdown of sort of community ties, right? Of commitment and loyalty to a larger community than the people who think just like you. And I think social media and the whole internet, sort of being able to curate what news you see so that it only echoes what you already think, all of those things. I mean, it used to be, in the 50s and 60s maybe, everybody watched Walter Cronkite, right? No matter what your political views were, everyone trusted that what he was saying was not fake news. And even if it was news they didn't like, people all sort of trusted that. I mean, there was kind of this, and that doesn't exist anymore, right? We don't have anything like that I can think of, where there's sort of universal, not universal, but near universal confidence that what you're being told by this particular source is likely to be accurate. Right. I don't know that we have that anymore. And I think that's a huge thing.
That's interesting, because I don't think of our history as being necessarily more happily heterogeneous or integrated.
Well, that's right. I mean, so that's the other thing, right, is that we have progressed in so many ways and are continuing to progress. And so there's many more voices now in the conversation than there used to be.
Yeah.
Right. Which is a really good thing, but it's also the society has to kind of then navigate that. So now we're having a much larger group of perspectives who are actually in the conversation, not on the sidelines of the mm-hmm. conversation. And so there's no one point of view that's sort of, you know, privileged, mm-hmm. or at least, I mean, there still are points of view that are privileged, but we're moving towards, hopefully, right, moving towards this place where that isn't the case. Mm-hmm. And so then how do you navigate that, right? How do you navigate so it's not the Garfield free-for-all? And it's challenging. I mean,
especially when you think of where do you see people disagree in media, it's going to look like the Garfield High School free-for-all. Right. Because our natural judgment is that conflict is exciting.
Right.
Respectful discourse is more boring.
Right. Right. Yep.
So maybe we want to end it by asking for your advice, Jana.
Yeah. We're trying to do this sort of philosophy out loud, collaborating on sort of different philosophical and cultural questions that are interesting to us. And I think for me, you know, someone who is more maybe used to the Garfield free-for-all, go Bulldogs, than I am with sort of both traditional philosophical inquiry and skills or even spaces where it's okay to be curious and stumble into things together. From your perspective, working in philosophy for children for so long and just in philosophy, what do you see as, you know, what would you advice would you give us in trying to pursue this project? And what would you see as some barriers to our success?
So I think if I were doing it, I would really be looking for a real diverse set of voices and diverse in all kinds of ways, right? From all kinds of perspectives, right? And including people with whom you're likely to really disagree. Because I think that would then provide a kind of model for engaging in these conversations in ways that can be enlightening and interesting. And that you can have conflict in terms of disagreement without rancor or name calling or et cetera, right? Because I think the more models we can provide of that kind of engagement, the better. And I totally think it's possible because I think that, I mean, I guess I really do think that people want to be connected to other people. I don't think people in general, I mean, most of the people I know, and I have friends from kind of all walks of life and politics. And I think most people are really uncomfortable with the sort of sense that the national conversation has gotten to the level of rancor and name calling that it has. And I think about like what happened this week, right? Where there was this simple little episode of Joe Biden talking to Meghan McCain about their joint experience dealing with people they love and brain cancer and how moved people were by that, right? How people have been writing in, like thousands of people who were really moved. Why are they moved? Because they see two people who generally disagree about most things making a real genuine connection. And I think that that's really powerful for people for a reason.
Well, we appreciate it. And thank you so much for being with us. Is there anything you would like to promote or send people to if they want to learn more?
So the only thing that that comes to my mind is I'm a big advocate of parents and grandparents spending time engaging philosophically with your own children. I found with my own three sons who are now all in their 20s that having had lots of time in which we've sort of thought about big questions together really strengthened our relationship in ways that I couldn't have even imagined then. And so I would say on our website, there's a page that are resources for parents and grandparents. And I would really encourage people to look at that, to go to some of the links. We have lists of picture books on our website and ideas for what questions they might raise with your kids. And if you're in Seattle, we do these events for parents, which are always on our website. If people get in touch on the website, they can become part of the mailing list and get more information. So those are the things that I I think, most on my mind at the moment.
That's the Center for Philosophy for Children website, right?
Yes.
Okay. They can just Google that and they'll find it.
Yes, really quick. Right. It's
great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks.
You're welcome.
No Narrow Thing is produced by Dustin Addington and Whitney Johnson. Artwork by Maris Antolin. Find her on Instagram as @MCAntolin. Music by Ryan Leba. Find him at gogowildcat.com. For more information, go to nonarrowthing.com.